Welcome. I'm Holly Kernan, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who's off today, and this is your call. We're less than 2 weeks away from the U.S. election, and this past Monday, we watched the final debate between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. The focus was on the Middle East, mainly Iran, Libya, Syria, and Israel. There was one mention of Latin America, but if you blinked, you probably missed it. So what else did you miss in this debate? Did you even tune in, or were you watching baseball? And has most media coverage become like sports coverage about who's ahead and who's behind? Did it make sense to focus the final presidential debate on foreign policy? What did you think of the coverage of it? And where do you go to find in-depth analysis about foreign policy issues? Well, joining us to talk about the week's news coverage and especially how the U.S. election is playing abroad, we have Eric Regley, who's a national security reporter with the Globe and Mail. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Holly.
Thanks for joining us.
A pleasure.
Eli Clifton writes for the American Independent News Network. Hi, Eli.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. You sound like you're in a fishbowl there. And Andres Contreras is the founder of Democracy Now! In Español. Welcome, Andres.
Buenos dias, Holly.
Buenos dias. So as we always do, as you all know, on Fridays, we like to give kudos to journalists who have done a particularly good job this week. So let's start with you, Andres. What did you see that you thought was done well?
One thing that we reported on Democracy Now! This week, Holly, was an incredible exchange between a journalist named Luke Rutkowski, who's with the media group called We Are the Change. This took place following the second debate between Obama and Romney. And Luke Rutkowski walked up to none other than representative from Florida, Debbie Wasserman, and asked, if President Romney becomes president, he's going to inherit President Obama's secret kill list. This is going to be debated. How do you think Romney will handle this kill list, and are you comfortable with him having a kill list? Okay, she went on to say, I have no idea what you're talking about, and she finally walked away, right? But the courage of this young journalist, this incredible, incisive question, goes to the heart of what's wrong with U.S. policy right now. And these journalists, including a colleague of his also who asked a very similar question to another person, Sierra Adamson asked Robert Gibbs a very similar question about the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son, ordered by President Obama because he was on the kill list.
And then these are killings by drones?
These are killings by drones, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Which did come up a little bit in the debate.
It did, correct.
And everybody seemed to be in the same position.
Right, and so it's important for journalists to go to where the silence is and to ask the questions that are really not being asked. And of course, this did not really fully come up in the debate.
Go where silence is. All right, so we're talking about kudos to journalists who are doing that kind of reporting. Eric, what did you want to give a nod to this week?
I'm based in Rome, Italy, Holly, and you remember 3 years ago there was an earthquake in L'Aquila, Italy, just outside of Rome. It killed 309 people. Well, what happened this week was the seismologists who were monitoring the tremors before the earthquake, they were convicted of manslaughter for, in effect, having to failed to predict the unpredictable. And it caused an outcrying in Europe. And there is one piece in the Financial Times of London which I quite liked. I'm going to mispronounce the author's name, but it's Anaja Ahuja, A-H-U-J-A. And the headline is, Jailing the Seismic 7 Will Cause Tremors Beyond Italy. And the author, I thought, it was a really good piece because it compared the this may be hyperbole, but it compared the persecution of these six seismologists to the persecution of Galileo, in the sense that their report that they put out several days before the actual earthquake did say there was a risk. In fact, there were tremors, and one of the six seismologists made the mistake of sort of an off-the-record, flippant remark telling a journalist, telling the people of Locula, saying, look, there's no problem, go home, have a glass of wine. That's exactly, he actually recommended what kind of wine to drink. Hmm. And then, kaboom, there was this fatal earthquake. And the judge says they're absolutely negligent. And I actually think that the author is right. This is an international embarrassment for Italy. And I thought this was, quite a very strong piece by this author in the FT, saying that it's to condemn these people, imprison them for manslaughter, they were being jailed for 6 years each, is really for not being able to predict the unpredictable is craziness.
Yeah, well, as an outsider, it just was a stunning verdict to me. In the general media in Italy, how is it being seen as a sort of crazy, or was there something rational about it that we don't understand?
Well, in the local press in Italy, certainly the papers in and around L'Aquila, which is a pretty big city, they were sympathetic to this because The seismologist, one of the seismologists, not in the report, but in this off-the-cuff remark, said, go home and have a glass of wine. So, yeah, there's a lot of hatred against these seismologists, but elsewhere in Italy, and certainly in the European press in general, they thought this was insane, absolutely insane. And it just reflects bad in Italy because the judicial system in Italy takes a lot of heat for not doing its job right.
Well, and we'll talk to you about that a little later in terms of former Prime Minister Berlusconi. But before we do that, let's, Eli, what piece of good reporting did you want to highlight?
Yeah, the piece that really caught my eye today, or actually this week, was a piece that came out on Tuesday in the New York Times by Isabel Kirshner about the efforts to get out the vote among Americans in Israel. Hmm. And specifically, it was examining an organization called I Vote Israel, which appears to be largely supported and funded through major Republican Party donors and operatives. Now, that doesn't inherent in any way mean that what they're doing is illegal. As a matter of fact, they look fairly closely at it and say that probably what they're doing is within the lines of American election law, which is that they are holding events in Israel, trying to register Americans to vote, and helping them vote early, as many people across the country have been doing this in this election. What I find interesting about this piece is that it highlights a number of things. First, how close this election might be in a number of swing states, particularly Florida, with a high Jewish American population. It seems as if this group is banking on the fact that they might be able to actually make a difference in Florida and in a number of other swing states by bringing out the relatively small number of American voters who they might be able to get from Israel. In the past, the number of Jewish Americans who have voted from Israel has been around 30,000. So it's not necessarily a large number. Even if they can double it, it still wouldn't be a particularly large number unless you can have them make a difference in a state that gets very, very close, as we well may see come election day next month. The other thing that I think it showed off very well was the fact that the Republican Party, particularly in this election, although even 4 years ago they were doing it, is making a much harder push for Jewish voters and trying to make Israel a central issue for their party, both for Christian Zionists as well as for Jewish Americans. And I think that's a noticeable shift that we're seeing in the Republican Party. That's not the Republican Party of 15 or 20 years ago, and it's a vast, fascinating thing to follow. All of that said, Jewish Americans continue to vote way, way, way disproportionately for Democrats and for President Obama. So it's definitely a tough road ahead they're facing.
All right. We'll put links to all of those articles at yourcallradio.org. And Eric, I wanted to ask you about another sentence in Italy, which is the one that came down today. An Italian court convicted former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to 4 years in jail for tax fraud in connection with the purchase of broadcasting rights. So can you tell us What's happening with that? And it seems inconceivable that Berlusconi would ever actually go to jail. What's the coverage like of that, and what's happening?
Well, the opposition parties, I mean, Holly, there's an election coming up. It'll be in the spring. So the parties who can't stand Berlusconi, and there's many, are delighted about this. They're saying, look, the truth finally comes out. He's a criminal. He's a fraudster. But listen, he calls himself the most persecuted government leader in history, and he may be right. He actually claims to have spent about €300 million, so that'd be about $400 million on legal fees. Since he became prime minister for the first time in 1994. He's been prime minister three times. And that's probably true. I mean, he's got, sex cases against him, tax cases, I mean, you name it. But he never, ever has stepped in a prison cell once, and my bet is he won't this time. Hmm. What he does, he's got the most cunning legal team on the planet. I mean, you and I should be so lucky to have these people to get into trouble. The standard tactic with Berlusconi, once he gets into trouble with the law, they appeal immediately, and they start this long process, and inevitably it runs into the statute of limitations, and it just vanishes. And that's what will probably happen this time. So look, no one absolutely believes he's going to go to prison, though. A lot of Italians are delighted that this is just more evidence that he was a crook.
Well, let's now turn to Monday night's foreign policy debate. It was about foreign policy, but it seemed shockingly limited, at least to me. So I'm wondering, first off, what did you think of the journalism on display during the debate? Did you think that the scope and framing of Bob Schieffer was under his control, or is it the Commission on Presidential Debates that's really dictating how everything goes? Why don't we start with you, Andres? What did you think of the journalism?
You know, Holly, the journalism has to be analyzed in terms of who's invited to the debate in the first place. And if, as the world looks at the debate, the only two candidates invited are from the Democratic and Republican parties. And yes, they are the two major parties. However, they are not the only parties. In fact, there are parties that have their candidates on states on those ballots that could conceivably win the presidential election if they won those states. And so those candidates should at least be invited. And so on Democracy Now!
That's something that was about the Commission on Presidential Debates. Bob Schieffer had no control over that.
That's true. But it does actually have to do with how a journalist can do their work in terms of expanding the questions and covering the issues that other candidates would have brought up. So in that sense, Bob Schieffer was really just focusing on the questions that were comfortable to both of these candidates, who mostly agreed with themselves in terms of foreign policy and military policy.
Yeah, and you were about to say that Democracy Now! Is trying to expand that by inviting third-party candidates on.
You know, for the first time, Democracy Now! Did something quite unique, and that is during the three presidential debates, we played live the debate itself, but then broke off after the questions, right, in order to expand it to other candidates, in this case from the Justice Party, Rocky Anderson, and from the Green Party, Dr. Jill Stein. And so that effort on our behalf really gave a perspective that so many people, both in this country and around the world, have no idea, in terms of bringing up the issues that are really, really vital, like global climate chaos. I mean, the world is really facing a very dangerous situation. In fact, the Pentagon some years ago said it's the most dangerous issue involving U.S. security, and yet it was not even touched.
There was no question really about that. Well, let me put that same question to Eric and Eli about the journalism on display. Glenn Greenwald writes in The Guardian, it was a perfect microcosm of America's political culture. You've got numerous foreign policy analysts and journalists who published lists of foreign policy questions, and none of them were asked or answered at this debate. Eric, why don't we start with you?
Holly, I was looking at this debate. I just listened to most of it again before you phoned. from a different perspective, since I am the European economics and business correspondent based in Europe, in Rome, I was looking at it from a different view. And I guess I was really disappointed that, you know, the world's biggest market, which is Europe, didn't come up in the questioning and didn't come up in the answers. I don't even think the word Europe came up at all.
Greece did. Romney brought up Greece, but that was it, I think.
Did he?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I missed that. It was basically non-existent. So I was disappointed in that, and certainly the European media was, and everyone I know. I mean, because, you know, this is a big story in Europe, and I think many Europeans were curious at best, insulted at worst, that Europe did not come up more in the questioning and in the answers.
Liberacion's Washington blog said that they were okay with the fact that Europe had disappeared from America's radar. But it really was curious that, particularly because Europe is doing austerity and the U.S. economic crisis is at the center of this presidential election, you would think that how Europe is dealing with this would have been a big question. How did the Europeans look at that, Eric?
Well, they were. A lot of Europeans are looking at just to get a view. I mean, they know what Obama's like. They know what to expect from Obama. But they don't know Romney at all. And they were looking at this to get a view of Romney. How might he react in a security crisis, an economic crisis? And I think they got a big bit of sense of that, and the sense is that, look, you know, Obama and Romney are not miles apart. In fact, they were very, very close. So I think there was a little bit of a comfort factor in that maybe Romney is not the trigger-happy madman that some commentators and Democrats say he is. On the other hand, I do think they were insulted that neither candidate talked about the European crisis or another topic which is very close to Europe, which is the plight of the Palestinians. I mean, that did not come up. It's certainly relationships with Israel, certainly Iran, Syria, what's happening there came up, but not the plight of the Palestinians. And I think Europeans
strange. Yeah, and that might get to what the New York Times article that we talked about earlier. Eli, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this, and especially what does it say about sort of mainstream or established journalism? Glenn Greenwald, again, I'm going to quote from him. He says that we have a media system that plays along willingly in the charade forged by the nation's ruling elite.
Well, I mean clearly, I think Glenn is on to something there. All that said, I agree with all the criticisms that have been leveled, but I guess I have a couple other thoughts to add to that. One is that, you know, all the rules can be laid out for these debates, and the questions can be as good as you want them to be. The reality is that neither candidate necessarily will be answering the questions that were put in front of them, and that was certainly the case in the debate. And there's nothing about that in the outline for the debates, which at least for one of the debates that was leaked, the contract essentially between both candidates which was facilitated by the folks managing and holding the debate. So obviously that's an aspect of it, and somebody like Bob Schieffer can only do so much to hold the candidates feet to the fire to answer the questions. More importantly, though, and I think something that we sometimes lose track of, and certainly I think outside of the United States gets lost track of, is the fact that these elections tend not to be won or lost on foreign policy or national security as a rule. It is simply not something that interests a large portion of the American public. Whether that's because of the media's failure to report on it and make this an issue that every American should be aware of and care about is a fair question to ask. But I think the reality, and I think we saw it in this debate, is that the candidates were, in some of the most absurd circumstances, trying to turn the answers to questions that were about foreign policy back to domestic issues, because that's where this election is going to be won or lost.
Which is why I sort of thought that Europe's austerity would have been an interesting place to go.
Well, I mean, certainly it did come up only in the context of sort of domestic discussion about the economy, where Mitt Romney had to comment about, you know, that Obama's policies will put us on the road to Greece. But I think for most Americans, it's not something that they pay attention to on a regular basis or follow as closely as some of us might. And I think that was very much reflected by the candidates. They're up there ultimately trying to win an election, and they're trying to get out the talking points and messaging that they think will resonate the best with the swing state voters as well as with their own base. And for them, that meant talking domestic policy, even in a debate which was supposed to be about national security and foreign policy.
Right. Well, and that's Eli Clifton. He writes for the American Independent News Network. We're also joined by Eric Regoli, who's a national security and economics correspondent with the Globe and Mail. He's based in Rome, Italy. And in studio, we have Andres Conteris, who is the founder of Democracy Now! In Español. And we're talking about the presidential debates. And another big area of the globe that was completely missing was Latin America. First off, how is Latin America looking at this presidential election, or countries in Latin America, or El Mundo Español?
You know, Holly, the folks in Latin America, the perspective there is that the U.S. has been acting like an empire for in terms of Latin America being the backyard. And so in some ways, these two candidates are competing with themselves in terms of who can be more militaristic, who can be more bellicose, who can treat other countries that you know are independent, as if they are dependents of the United States. You know, it's very interesting that Romney did not criticize Obama for breaking some of his promises. Like, Obama said that he was going to shut down Guantanamo. You know, it's incredible that Obama didn't do this, first of all. And he's not bringing it up whatsoever in this campaign. But either is Romney. And why? Because Romney thinks we should increase the Guantanamos of the world.
And there's that trial going on right now, which would have been a very good time. Khalil Sheikh Mohammed, I think it is,
yes.
Is happening in Guantanamo. So that might have been a very good opportunity to bring it up.
Totally. And that brings up the whole issue of you know, treatment of prisoners and interrogation and in so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, which Romney, especially in the primary campaign, came out the strongest as being pro-torture than any other candidate, practically. And it's just incredible. So, Obama really is not living up to that promise. And on the domestic front, you'd think that Romney could criticize Obama for not fulfilling his promise to raise the minimum wage. But of course he does not want to bring that up because Romney himself is not going to do anything to help those who are at the minimum wage in this country. So.
All right. That is Andres Conteris. He is the founder of Democracy Now! In Español. We're also joined by Eli Clifton, who's a national security correspondent and economics correspondent at the American Independent News Network, and Eric Regoli, who's the European business correspondent for the Globe and Mail, which is Canada's national newspaper. But Eric is in Italy. And we also want to take your calls during this hour. We're at 866-798-8255. You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can post comments now. That's yourcallradio.org. And you can also read all of the articles that we're talking about there. And what do you think about media coverage of the last presidential debate? Were you watching it? Where do you get your news on foreign policy? And do you think that these debates are a good representation of where U.S. foreign policy is heading? And what role are media playing in keeping the public informed and engaged? As one of our guests mentioned, 866-798-8255, or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. Did you know that your unwanted car, boat, or RV can make a wonderful gift? It does if you give it to Local Public Radio, KALW. If you have a vehicle, motorcycle, a boat, a car that you'd like to give away, to donate, that is, to Local Public Radio, KALW, it'll help support your local public radio station. All the information on this program is available at KALW.org, or you can call 888-KALW-CAR. 1-888-KALW-CAR.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm sitting in for Rosa Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Speaking of that, on Monday, former Iran hostage Shane Bauer will be joining us. He just wrote an article in Mother Jones magazine. After being released from prison in Iran, he decided to look into solitary confinement conditions in U.S. prisons, and he'll join us to talk about what he found out. And if you have a show idea for us, you could drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can call us now to join our media roundtable discussion. 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number. That's 866-798-8255. We're discussing foreign policy coverage and global coverage of the U.S. elections and debates. And speaking of that, so Andres, we were talking a little bit about Latin America and the response, but what are some of the big Latin American stories that you think are missing in U.S. coverage that we might not know about?
You know, one thing has to do with sovereignty for Latin American countries and the whole issue of U.S. military presence in Latin America is a big, big one. The United States, under the Obama administration, has continued something initiated by Bush, which is commencing the Fourth Fleet, which really covers Latin America militarily. And this fleet had been basically out of commission, and Bush initiated it, but Obama has continued it. Obama has also continue the policy of what the U.S. Southern Command wants, which is to have a very strong military presence. But in Latin America, there's been a very clear movement against this. For instance, President Correa in Ecuador, when the issue of whether the agreement between Ecuador and the U.S. would be renewed for the base of Manta, the Manta Naval and air base
in Ecuador,
would be renewed for another 10 years. Basically, President Correa said, well, yes, we can renew it if the U.S. agrees to have an Ecuadorian base in Florida. You know, it's like, and of course...
Did the U.S. agree to that?
Actually, so, you know, it's an absurd question, really. But why is it absurd? What gives the United States the right to have over 1,000 military bases and presences around the world? Okay, publicly there are some over 700 that the Pentagon agrees to, and
you mean discloses?
Agrees to disclose, and but there are many secret military bases around the world. But there's been a movement, really, in Latin America to not allow this to continue. This is very similar to the training of Latin American soldiers at the U.S. military academy called the School of the Americas, which has officially changed its name and is now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. But the movement to shut down the School of the Americas keeps using the same name, and basically it's what they say is it's the new name with the same shame. In other words, torture manuals have been found to be part of the curriculum of that academy historically, and the kind of training that takes place there leads to human rights violators becoming dictators in Latin America and so forth. So, but the movement in Latin America is now to stop sending soldiers to the School of the Americas. And this has now been adopted by quite a few countries, including Ecuador, including Venezuela, Argentina, Uruguay. So that is an amazing change that shows that they're willing to face up to U.S. policy.
And Andres, that's Andres Conteris with Democracy Now! In Español. And we'll ask him about Honduras and his experience with the ex-president Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted. So we'll ask you about that in just a sec, but I want to get to some of our callers. Roger in San Francisco, go ahead. Welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you, Holly.
Yeah.
I'd like to make three quick points. First of all, let me say I'm very pro-military. I was in the Marines from my 16th year to my 21st year. But using the military to solve our problems is a sign of failure. The real answer is diplomacy in the State Department. We have to work on changing our image, particularly in the Middle East. It's I was disappointed that they both were so pro-military on that debate. The second point I'd like to make is I listen to radio. I get my news primarily from radio. It is the fastest disseminator of news. I listen to your program or your station. I listen to KQED. I listen to KGO. All of you do wonderful jobs in disseminating news. And the third point is this show is wonderful, but it deserves 2 hours. 1 hour is just not enough.
All right. Well, we like that, Roger. Thank you very much for your kudos and for your comments. So let me put that to you, Eric, about the military. You know, the military as a way to solve problems. Everybody in the debate, Romney and Obama, I mean, the two men in the debate were very militaristic, very jingoistic. How is that in Europe? Europe is decreasing its military right now, right?
Well, it is, and that's because of the Eurozone as a whole. The 17 countries in the Eurozone are in recession, and military budgets are being cut back. Actually, the one place, oddly, they're not being cut back is Greece, which likes to think that it's going to be invaded by Turkey any minute. But yeah, the military is taking a lesser and lesser role here, much to the Americans' annoyance. You know, they had to they've had to come rescue the Europeans a few times. So in Libya, it was largely a European bombing campaign, not an American one. But yes, the general sense is here is that the Americans like to bomb people into democracy, and they're very afraid about Iran. They're very afraid that the Americans will allow Israel after the election, maybe even encourage, I don't know, to bomb Iran. And they're worried about that because the economy is so fragile now in Europe. If Iran is bombed, the oil prices would, you know, will certainly rise. By how much, we don't know. But it's, you know, it's one of OPEC's biggest exporters. So there's an economic fear as well as a humanitarian fear. Now, having said that, Holly, I'll just say that in the debate, it didn't look like either man was ready to hit the bomb Iran button. They both said that they would stand by Israel if Israel were attacked. They didn't say, you know, we're going to allow Israel to do what it wants to do. So they took some comfort in that, I think.
And Eli, let me bring you back into the conversation. Thanks for that, Eric. I'm going to switch gears, and I wanted to ask you about the effect of social media. I know you were tweeting the debate. Most people are these days. Mother Jones had this article this week by Kevin Drum saying, you know, how Twitter is ruining political journalism. And essentially, the author says reporters need to fight this bubble, and Twitter is getting us further and deeper into the bubble. Obviously, there's a whole counter argument to that it's expanding the debate. But what do you think about the effect of social media, Eli?
Well, I mean, truth be told, I'm a relative newcomer to it compared to some of the people I work with. But certainly within, I think there's two areas to look at it with. One, and I think it's an area that's not looked at and hasn't been discussed much, is how it functions within the Washington bubble of think tanks and journalists. And it's very interesting, as somebody who's participated in it as well as watched it, to see that you get to see very interesting discussions, but you also get to see, to a degree, the Beltway groupthink, that, you know, these are the same people talking to each other, disagreeing on the same points, and outside voices coming in is relatively uncommon, not because they're excluded, but because, for the most part, it's just ignored that this phenomenon even exists, or that people would want to participate in it. So I think that that's one aspect to it. Another part, which I think is, I don't know if it's good or bad, is that it tends to be the snarkier comments, mm-hmm. snarkier tweets, are the ones that get the most retweets and get the most attention. You know, I mean, when I'm tweeting during the debate, I find myself falling into that sort of snarky space. And I think it kind of hit home for me when, you know, probably one of the more off-the-cuff tweets I had ever done was during the first debate when Mitt Romney made the comment about cutting PBS funding and that he would cut Big Bird and Sesame Street. And I think I tweeted that that Barack Obama had authorized the killing of Bin Laden, and Mitt Romney would put a hit on Big Bird. And this tweet, you know, got retweeted like 600 times and was written up by the AFP and translated into a lot of different languages. And at one level, I was very proud of it. At the same time, I was thinking, you know, this wasn't the most insightful thing I had said, and I hope I have said things that had a little more depth to them than this. But, you know, this is the thing that gets picked up and gets repeated. So I'm probably a reflection on all of us that this is the type of thing that journalists who cover this get rewarded for.
And that's Eli Clifton. He writes for the American Independent News Network. We're also joined by Eric Regley, who's a national security and economics correspondent with the Globe and Mail. And in studio, Andres Conteris, who's founder of Democracy Now! In Español. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan in for Rose Aguilar today. And you can join us. We have one open line, 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. I'll get to you in just a moment, Stuart in San Francisco. Hold on. But I just wanted to ask Andres about the Twitter question. Is it making us more shallow? I know Democracy Now! Is doing a lot, using Twitter a lot.
I think it has a double edge because it does encourage participatory involvement in journalism. It really converts individuals who never would have been reporting to really analyze the situation and try to concisely put in a few words and put it out there in a tweet or on Facebook or wherever. That is something that we at Democracy Now! Really believe in and encourage. However, the other side of that is that it does not encourage a deeper analysis mm-hmm. into the issues. And so we on our show try to give time for longer interviews and in more in-depth coverage of particular matters. And so, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages of both.
Let's go to Jerry in Cupertino. Hi, Jerry.
Your commentator just mentioned the thing that I was going to talk about, which is that if you're listening to, I'm kind of old, so I'm not on social media per se, but if you're listening to a debate and you hear something and say, oh, I better tweet on that, how much of the debate then do you not listen to? So you know, I mean, when people basically watch debates on television, and this is, you know, in past years, or listen to it on the radio, I listen to the debates on the radio myself, the next day you go to the water cooler, you start talking to other people about what you heard and how it affected you, you know, after a little bit of thought. But, you know, I'm sure that there were a bazillion tweets, for example, after Romney mentioned the thing about binders of women.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I just wonder what those people were doing. I mean, they were obviously, they heard binders of women. Oh, let me grab my telephone or something and start tweeting on this and looking at the responses to my tweet and checking how many people are following my tweet. Meanwhile, how much important information from the debate are they missing?
So why don't we ask that, Jerry? Let's ask that of Eric Regley, who also is a regular on Twitter.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Holly, I didn't hear a word of the caller's call. I've got a very bad connection here, so maybe
I'm
you
sorry.
Can paraphrase.
Yeah, let me just paraphrase. Essentially, he said, if you're doing your snarky tweet about the binders of women, for example, or maybe Big Bird, are you missing the substance of what else is happening in that debate? Are you focused on paying attention to who's following your tweets and what's trending now that you're not actually able to follow the substance of the debate? I mean, it gets back to the essential question that we were talking about before this. Is social media making us more shallow? Is it dictating this kind of conventional wisdom on the spot by halfway through the debate as to who won, et cetera? Go ahead, Eric. That's...
Sure, yeah. I mean, I more or less agree with Andres on this. I think his response was bang on. I mean, my problem with Twitter, even though I use it and follow, in fact, get some stories off it, because a lot of it's posted very quickly from analysts and economists. My problem with it is it's showboating. It's you're showing off who can be the wittiest, snarkiest, fastest right off the bat. So it really is. It descends into comedy at points. But also having said that, you know, the half-life of these social mediums is pretty short. And, you know, I tend not to get too verklempt about this because I don't know if Twitter's going to be around in a few years. You know, I'm already getting bored of it. You know, I don't go on it nearly as much as I used to because for that reason, I just find it less and less informative all the time. It's people showing off.
People showing off. You're listening to Your Call. That's Eric Reguli with the Globe and Mail. We've also got Eli Clifton on it with us from the American Independent News Network and Andres Conteris, who's the founder of Democracy Now! In Español. We have an open line if you want to join our conversation about the week's media coverage, and we're focused on foreign policy and last week's debate. 1-866-798-8255 is the number to call. That's 866-798-8255. And let's go to Paul in Santa Cruz. Welcome to your call, Paul.
Thank you for taking my call. Very important discussion. What frustrates me most in the news and the mainstream media, and I would even include Democracy Now!, is that it's so Eurocentric that it takes a look at world events from the perspective of how it affects the major powers, and we don't really hear about the daily lives of the victims of U.S. policy and European policy. So I tend to get my news on non-mainstream internet radio, including sources like UhuruNews.com, where you can actually hear from revolutionary voices in this country and around the world about what's going on the ground daily for the people who have to suffer under the policies of the major powers in this world.
Well, thank you for that, Paul. I'm gonna put that question to Andres about this kind of Eurocentric nature of our coverage. What do you say?
You know, Paul, I think your criticism is well founded, and I in part totally agree with you. However, I think you would agree that that's not, especially those of us in Democracy Now!, we also do give space for the real life stories on the ground and how people's lives are deeply affected by these policies. So, you know, we covered the UndocuBus that arrived there at the convention, the presidential convention there in North Carolina, and heard stories directly from those who are impacted by the U.S. immigration policy and Obama's promise to change it, and of course that not going through because in part because of Republican blockage, but in part because he didn't make it a really high priority. So we try to do both, but I think what your comment is very well taken.
And thank you for that, Paul. It gives me an opportunity to actually ask about an undercovered story that you covered extensively, which was the ouster of President Manuel Zelaya in Honduras, and he's back now. So tell us about being with him and what happened there, just sort of briefly, and I want to try and get another call in after that.
Very briefly. President Manuel Zelaya was elected in Honduras and overthrown in a military coup in June of 2009. I was in Honduras shortly after that and ended up being in the country when he snuck into the country. He tried to return to the country. They wouldn't allow him, so he snuck in and he ended up at the Brazilian embassy. I went there to cover the story. I thought I would go in for a few hours. I ended up staying a few months and had no idea that would happen because if I would have left, then they would not have allowed me to return. So I got to know the president and his family quite well and covered the story for quite a few media outlets. And the situation now, and ended up being on the plane when he returned to the country officially, and we covered his return. And now he is part of what's called the resistance in Honduras, and his wife, Xiomara Castro de Zelaya, is the presidential candidate for the next elections. That the primary will be held next month in Honduras, and then the presidential election will take place next year. So President Zelaya is very much on the scene, but also the context needs to be understood in that Honduras is one of the most violent places in the world right now.
And it's the most violent place in the Americas, right?
It is, absolutely.
Yeah, and we almost never hear about it.
No, we don't hear about it. And it's really, really pathetic that, again, this is one of the silenced issues that we never hear about. And U.S. policy has a great deal to do with it because it continues to have one of the largest U.S. military bases in Central America is right there in Honduras at Palmarola. It's called Sotocano. And the U.S. Southern Command is very, very interested in continuing that. And so they overlook the atrocities that the government of President Pepe Lobo is involved in there in Honduras.
It's an unfortunate name, Lobo, mm-hmm. Wolf. So let me go to Raul as our next caller. Hi, Raul. Welcome to your call. Are you there? Raul, you're on your call. Are we having phone issues again? Caramba. Are we good? Raul, welcome to your call. Hi, sorry about that.
No problem. I actually changed my comment. One of the subjects that was not covered at all is the subject of global warming and climate change. And the alternative media has also really done a bad job of this thing. Specifically, I'm going to reference the pipeline that's coming from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico. But the really big story is that they're expanding the Panama Canal to accommodate huge oil tankers that will be taking that oil to China and to India. And there has been nothing at all in the news, alternative or otherwise, that covers that aspect of the story. That's all.
Thank you so much, Raul. Let me put that to Eli and Eric first. Eli, what do you think about the lack of coverage of global climate change, and how does it compare the U.S. coverage with other outlets?
Well, I think that's absolutely true, and that's a message, interestingly, which has come out of the Pentagon in a number of reports, either commissioned by the Pentagon or even, I think, some conducted within it, which have essentially said that a number of the effects of global warming, specifically rising sea levels, will, over the next 100 years, quite possibly be the overarching issue which influences America's the United States national security outlook. So I think that's something very important. And sadly, I think that this sort of, for lack of a better term, a realist perspective on American foreign policy, which is, you know, kind of a harsh way of looking at it, but basically saying that the United States has some defined interests and we should rationally pursue those policies which help us further them, is actually something that is sadly been missing from the discussion that's gone on, be it climate change or, for that matter, issues around the Middle East, of having a really honest discussion about, you know, what exactly are the United States' interests, security interests, in a specific region, and how are we going to pursue them? And I think that the interesting thing is that I suspect a lot of the policies that would be implemented if we followed that model would actually fall in line with what a lot of progressives would like to see happen.
Thank you for that. Eric, did you want to talk about global climate change and how it's covered? Oh, we might have lost Eric. That might have been our...
No.
Oh,
I'm
you're
here.
There.
I'm
Yay.
Here.
Good.
Yeah. I think it's absolutely appalling, the lack of debate in the United States and in Canada about this. Also in Europe, though the Europeans tend to be a bit more on the ball about this. But look, the Arctic ice cap is at a record low. It's about the most pessimistic predictions for an ice-free Arctic summer a few years ago were 2100. Mm-hmm. Now, then it went to 2050, then 2025. There are some very, very well-known scientists now who think that the Arctic will be ice-free in the summer in as little as 3 or 4 years. So the climate is changing rapidly, and that opens up, you know, we have to have a debate about how humanity, how economies, how species can adapt or not that quickly to this rapid climate change. And it's entirely absent from the debate in North America, less so in Europe, but I do think it's appalling because, you know, the European debt crisis will fix itself in time, but this is a long-term problem, climate change.
Which may not be suited to the way that politics, which is very short-term. Chris in Oakland writes, no, social media is not making us more shallow. Mainstream society was shallow enough to begin with. Social media is just a new outlet that magnifies it. And Karen writes, I listen regularly to the Media Roundtable, and I have a comment on Twitter and journalism. I agree with the side that says Twitter is ruining journalism. Twitter rewards the shot zinger, the soundbite. I can't remember the number of times a serious program where I've made a snarky remark, a verbal tweet, and missed an important comment because of it. Twitter is a distraction. And that's from Karen. Thank you for that. And we just have a couple of minutes left, Andres, so I'm going to go to you. How do you think that journalists should be covering foreign policy, say in a perfect world? What might we be doing differently?
What we might be doing differently is really going to, like I said earlier, going to where the silence is, and to see that dominant media is really interested in continuing the policies that are really not democratic in terms of the U.S. in this hemisphere, for one example. And so what we need to do is really, really listen to those who are trying to say that U.S. foreign policy needs to change from, for example, what was said in the late 1940s. We represent 5% of the world's population. We control nearly half of the world's resources. Our job in this century is to maintain the disparity. This was basically voiced as U.S. foreign policy, and it continues to be in a way, though it's not said so directly nowadays. And that is what needs to be changing in order to really follow through with our values of democracy.
All right. Thank you for that. That is Andres Conteris, and he is the founder of Democracy Now! In Español. We've also been joined by Eli Clifton, who's a correspondent with the American Independent News Network. Thank you, Eli. And Eric Reguli, who is the European business correspondent for the Globe and Mail, which is Canada's national newspaper. And Eric joined us from Italy. And I want to thank everybody who joined us by phone and by email. I'm sorry we couldn't get to everybody. We'll put web links and resources at our website. It's yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up on Monday. What is the reality of solitary confinement in U.S. prisons? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with investigative journalist and former hostage Shane Bauer about California's Pelican Bay Prison's special housing units, or SHUs. Join us live at 10 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. What are the long-term mental health effects of near-total isolation? It's Your Call with me, Holly Kernan, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.
Is a resignation letter so scathing or so public? In the pages of the New York Times, Greg Smith laid out his reasons for quitting a high-paid job with investment bank Goldman Sachs. Greg says Goldman Sachs is morally bankrupt and engages in unscrupulous practices. He's now written a book about his experience. He will speak with me about turning the page on Goldman.
Day 6 coming up this evening at 6 here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. Following that, it's Left, Right, and Center at 7, Counterspin at 7:30, and then tonight at 8, My Word and My Music from the BBC. Speaking of the Beeb, coming up next, it's World Have Your Say, and following that at noon today, the Tavis Smiley Show. Sunny skies forecast for the Bay Area today. We should see temperatures in the low to mid-60s downtown San Francisco, and light southerly winds, 5 to 10 miles per hour later this afternoon. 11 o'clock is the time. This is Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco.
I'm Colin Archplay. I was a U.S. Marine for 4 years. Welcome to World Have Your Say on BBC and locally on KPBS.
While Colin was in the military, we as a family had health benefits. Once he got out, the benefits continue for the veteran, but stop for the family. I don't think that's right.
My wife Karen and I run Archie's Acres. We teach veterans and those in active service skills we hope will have them get non-military jobs. We've asked them to step out of the classroom and talk about how they have found working for the U.S. military. I definitely have a couple of questions I'd like to ask them. I wonder if they realize how much responsibility will be loaded on their shoulders. And now they're back from Iraq and Afghanistan, do they feel appreciated by Americans? Those are my questions, but yours are welcome too. You can email worldhaveyoursay@bbc.com.